Hello, this is Jesse Liberty, and this is yet another podcast. Today I have Chris Ergel. Chris is a fellow Telerik evangelist. He's a C-sharp MVP, and he's an iNeta director, which I definitely want to ask about. He's also a really interesting guy. Chris, how are you?
I'm doing great. How about you, Jesse?
I'm doing well, thank you. Let's start. There's a number of things I want to talk to you about, but let's start really briefly with iNeta. Tell me a little bit about iNeta and what being a director means.
iNeta is the International .NET User Group Association. We've been around for, I think, a decade now, and we basically help the community find speakers, get speakers into the different user groups. We help establish user groups. If you are thinking about creating your own development user group, you can contact your local iNeta representative, or you can go online. There's actually an application form on iNeta.org, and apply. And once we get you into the system, we pretty much just help you out. We are about the community. We are a not-for-profit.
That's very cool. And I know that some of the best speakers on the circuit are all iNeta speakers, and that you place speakers in various user groups. And are you involved with conferences as well?
I am putting together a conference right now, a day of Windows 8, and actually I've invited you and Phil Jepitsky to come along and tell everyone about Windows 8 programming and maybe take part in some labs. As far as iNeta goes, I'm actually the director of the speaker program, and we've actually changed since you've probably since you've actually been familiar with the speaker program. It used to be kind of exclusive. We kind of got this reputation of being a little private club, and we've changed in the past couple of years to be what's known as the community speakers program. So if anyone wants to go out to the user groups in the community and speak, we help cover some of the cost for your transportation. That's really anybody. If you have something interesting to talk about, please sign up as a speaker. We'll definitely love to help you out. We want to spread knowledge throughout the entire development community.
Well, that's great. And I know that you have been speaking on a number of topics on C# and on Lambda expressions and on Link. Can you tell me a little bit about what kinds of things you tend to cover?
I suppose it all started back in 2009. With a presentation I started putting together called C# Ninjutsu. Nowadays, I call it declarative refactoring, but I kind of noticed due to Link coming into the picture with C#, that and actually many of the functional paradigms that we have nowadays, that C#, the rules people would follow for object-oriented programming, are slightly different. That's because C#, whereas it started as a purely object-oriented programming language, has picked up pieces of other programming paradigms along the way, such as generic programming that we got in 2005. But those functional aspects really do lend themselves to thinking a little differently. And what I noticed at the time, I didn't really recognize it for what it was, and that's why I called it C# Ninjutsu. It was kind of like a presentation about some modifications to the rules you're used to that you should follow to write good code, or very readable, maintainable code. And what it came down to was that it led to writing very declarative code, code that states your intent and making it very readable. I would say that if you use Link, right, Jesse?
Yes.
Notice how it manipulates sequences. That's what people are primarily used to seeing about out of Link. It manipulates sequences, and it's actually a DSL, a domain-specific language. Having those types of DSLs, it leads to better code that you can read, almost like English, but not quite. Of course, we're still in a programming language, and English is very ambiguous. So I put this presentation together and went around giving out some of the newer rules, things like favor immutability, strive for functional cohesion, but that was primarily a clarification over the strive for high cohesion. And actually, I think I want to dive into that just a little bit.
Sure. What does it mean to strive for functional cohesion?
Well, there's many different forms of cohesion. We all hear this strive for high cohesion, but what does that mean? And if you go and look at the different forms of cohesion, there are things like coincidental cohesion. If you have a utility class, and I'm sure you've seen utility classes, that has coincidental cohesion. That's just a class where you just threw stuff into it, and so you could access it later without thinking about how it should actually be structured within your program. A higher form of that would be logical cohesion. Those are your helper classes. This is like a utility class, but every single method within that that helper class is a it pertains to one particular subject, usually one class. Like if I had a string helper, every method manipulates strings. Well, functional cohesion is kind of like the flip side of the single responsibility principle, that your classes and methods should have one single responsibility, and that is that they should actually have all their responsibility. They should, if I'm manipulating strings, that functionality really kind of belongs to the string. And what we got in C# in 2008 were extension methods. And extension methods allow us to take these helper classes with logical cohesion and apply that functionality back to where they belong. So even though our source code is structured in such a manner that has logical cohesion, the way you utilize that source code with extension methods provides functional cohesion.
Okay, that makes sense. And so you're refactoring the pieces that were in your helper class back into extension methods so that the class is comprehensive, has everything that has to do with strings or in the string class.
It leads to having fluent interfaces, which is a very declarative form of programming. They do require you to think a little bit more about your API and how you're structuring it. But if you're not aware of fluent interfaces, it depends on method chaining and retaining the same context. Like if I'm using link, it's a fluent interface. Every method that continues the chain returns another enumerable. Well, I'm talking about link to object, of course. So if I have an enumerable string, I do some manipulation. Say I do a select to project the strings to integers. That would return an enumerable int. And so it's retaining that context of the enumerable so I can continue operating on sequences. So fluent interfaces provide make it very easy for you to provide DSL. There are other forms of DSL, domain-specific languages as well.
Okay, but, so bring this together for me with a couple specifics. If I'm a C# programmer and I'm intrigued by what you're saying, the first thing I need to do is to learn link. And then what? What do I need to do to get the goodness of functional programming?
Okay, well, I'm only touching upon a very small portion of functional programming. It's probably more in the declarative programming realm. I would consider extension methods as being probably one of the most functional features of C# because it allows me to define functions and then forward types to those functions. So a very specific example, I wouldn't necessarily say you have to know link, but you should know it if you're a C# developer, and that sort of thinking will lead you down that path. The best example I can think of is if I refactor a large loop with a bunch, I have a for each loop, I have another for each loop, I'm taking items from one list and sticking them in another. If I refactor that to link, usually I can get that down to one statement or one small chain of statements. If I take those same types of concepts with the extension methods and I actually name what I'm doing instead of depending upon the actual lambda expression, which defines the thing that changes. If I actually name those, I end up with an API that says exactly what it's doing. And you can take those same concepts and apply them to places that have nothing to do with link.
Let me just zero in on what you just said and see if I can tease out. You're saying if I take a series of link statements and name them, what do you mean by that?
Say I have a certain type of filter. I have a where. Say I have an enumerable of employees. So I have this sequence of employees. The reason I'm using where and enumerable employees is that it applies itself to anything that implements enumerable of employee. So it could be an array, it could be a list, it could be anything. So I have this filter that specifically filters by, say, employees who started after a certain date. Instead of making dot where and possibly reusing that in different pieces of the code, I can extract that particular where statement, that particular filter, and make an extension method, an enumerable employee, that says a filter by start date and let someone pass in the date, which would take some of that functionality that you're repeating throughout your code and put it in one place. So if it actually needs to change, you can change it. without any problems and without having to go through hundreds of files.
Okay, and so then it would no longer appear in my link statement. It would appear as a separate apparent method call?
Yes, it would look like any enumerable of employees, any array of employees actually has this method on it. I would, instead of actually utilizing the link method, I'm really just giving it a name and passing through. Because if I'm going to implement most likely what I'm going to do, since there isn't much of, there's actually no performance hit from this, but since it should be inlined, I'll just end up calling sequence dot where inside the body of that particular method, that method I extracted. Okay. And it's still using link. It's still that, in that case, it's still using link. It's just I named this particular implementation.
One of your presentations is called Legend of Lambda. What's that about?
I was doing this presentation and I kind of got in my head I should actually give a presentation that took someone through the fundamentals. Actually, this came about, I had a speaker at my user group. I run the Columbia Enterprise Developers Guild. And I had a speaker there giving a presentation on patterns, and I kind of asked him about Lambda abuse. And we don't really need to get into it unless you really want to, but Lambda abuse is a very specific anti-pattern. It was first introduced in, I think, the ASP.NET MVC extensions project. It might have been ASP.NET MVC toolkit. I can't remember. It's one or the other. But that was the first time I had seen it a few years ago. And I kind of kept it in my back pocket just because it's something fun to discuss, because it's one of those weird language tricks you can do utilizing reflection and lambdas. So I asked the speaker about that, and he told me that as the architect in his organization, he doesn't allow his developers to use lambda expressions. Obviously, I think he had the impression that lambda abuse is the overuse of lambda expressions. So I was kind of taken aback. I was like, why not? And he told me, well, they're difficult to understand. I can't teach them to junior developers. I want everyone to use something everyone understands. And I was like, I can teach lambda expressions to anyone, including junior developers. Well, I guess you guys have a little bit of background in C# or computer science. I can teach this to anyone in like 20 minutes or maybe half an hour at the most. And he disagreed with me that was possible. So I put together this presentation. In the very first 20 minutes of it, I go through the entire history of lambda expressions in C# and where they come from. And once you see it, how it evolves over time, it makes perfect sense to everyone. I don't think I've had a single person at my presentation be confused by it. Of course, after that in my presentation, I dive into all the other functional techniques you can use in C#. Some of them you necessarily shouldn't use because they're not as fluid as they are in languages like F#. But like currying, for example, I'll show people how to do currying manually.
And what is that? Wait, I got to interrupt you. What is that?
Was currying?
Yeah.
Imagine this. I have a function that takes in two parameters, okay, or two arguments. So I have a function x, y. So you're following me? Function x, y? Okay, I can actually break this down into two smaller functions. Think about this. I'm going to make the contention here that no function needs more than one argument ever. Does that sound kind of crazy?
Okay.
I mean, we know that methods are functions in C#. Can you imagine someone saying, well, you never need to actually have more than one argument? The reason that is, particularly with functions that can be broken down like this, is think about that function xy, fxy. That can be turned into fxfy. I can make the function take the first argument and return the next piece of the function. And I can extend that on forever. It's just like a big function chain, taking an argument, returning the next function that takes the next argument.
I can see that you can do that. I guess the question is, why do you want to do that?
Okay, so in C#, it's kind of a pain. I probably wouldn't recommend currying in most cases. In fact, I'm having trouble coming up with a good example of where you would use it in C#. It's very useful when you have a language like F# that actually has it implemented in the language, because I can call any function with any number of arguments that I want, and it'll give me a function that the remaining function that needs to take the other arguments.
Okay.
Now you can do part of this The actual useful part of this is called partial application. And this is where you apply an argument to a function. And the reason this is useful is because it can give you a function of a different shape. If I have a piece of the system that takes in a func int comma int, but I have a function that has two arguments, so it's func int comma int comma int, I can apply one argument to it and get back the function of the right shape so I can pass it to the other method. Make sense?
Yes. So you make these presentations at various user groups and at various conferences. And how does this tie back into the work that you do for Telerik? Which products do you support and how do these tie together?
Well, I support the Just line of products, Just Code, Just Trace, Just Decompile, and Just Mock. They don't really tie back directly. At Telerik, we believe in supporting the community, and I'm sent out to give instruction on all kinds of things with programming. While I'm doing the presentations, of course, I have my tools like Just Code installed, and sometimes people ask me what's going on there. How was I able to refactor this particular line that quickly? That's how it really ties back. It's really just Telerik doing goodwill to the community, and if I get to utilize my projects in the course of this, then that's great.
Okay, well, I don't want to do a commercial for Telerik, but I do want briefly to understand what those various products are. So Just Code is used for refactoring and for examining your code at design time. Do I have that right?
That's part of it. I guess the best way to put Just Code is it's a Visual Studio productivity tool. The part about Just Code that really makes it stand out is that it's unobtrusive. It feels like you're still in Visual Studio. There's nothing that's breaking that wall. So while you're in there, you feel like you're using Visual Studio. You get superior analysis. Sometimes I demonstrate and I show like Nerd Dinner and how it compiles and the Visual Studio compiler comes up with nothing. It compiles perfectly fine, but with Just Code, if I look at the errors, I have all kinds of problems with the CSS and the HTML and everything. And Just Code lets me know that for all those various languages. C#, Visual Basic, HTML, CSS, SAML, you name it. And we might be adding support for some other things in the future. Hint, hint. So the other products I have, by the way, I guess with Just Code, I really don't want to do a commercial here either. I really just want to kind of provide some information for the audience. When I say Visual Studio productivity tool, it does more than the blazing fast analysis that it already does, and it runs out of process. It also has a unit test runner that utilizes many different unit test frameworks, including JavaScript unit testing frameworks. It has... I think the most exciting new feature is probably the Visual Studio settings in the cloud. And that allows me to actually upload my settings from my Visual Studio. And I usually automatically sync it. So in this case, with the Visual Studio settings, it downloads them automatically. So on my laptop, if I've made changes using my desktop's Visual Studio, my laptop will get it automatically. So it keeps everything in sync and enables me to go play around with settings and get back to the original setting very easily. And it stores the theme settings.
And in a sentence or two, what are the other Just products?
Just Trace is our memory and performance profiling tool. So if it's very easy to use. You can click when you load it up, it actually kind of guides you along and what you're looking for and whether it's a performance issue, a memory leak, or whatever. And we strive to make it easy to use. And I think it's pretty wonderful. Just Mock is our mocking framework. So if you're doing unit testing, say you're using InUnit or MSpec or something, or one of those other unit testing frameworks that are out there, you can use Just Mock to mock your dependencies. Even if you don't have a good separation, you can use Just Mock to mock just about anything. Just Decompile is our free decompilation tool, and everyone should have a copy of that because it was awesome to be able to take an assembly and load it up, get your source code back out if you've lost the files.
So if I take Just Decompile and I point that at an exe, I'm going to get back something that approximates source code.
Yes. As you know, .NET compiles down to IL, or CIL is what we call it nowadays. We used to call it MSIL. So the Common Intermediate Language, it compiles down to the bytecode version of that. A disassembler which actually one of them comes with the Windows SDK, I believe, ILDASM. It will actually take that bytecode and put it back in the human readable form of IO. Well, what a decompiler, like Just Decompile, does is it'll take that bytecode. It will get to that process where it goes back into English, but it also builds a syntax tree. And from that syntax tree, it's able to generate source code in various languages. So it's not the original source code. It's a representation of the source code that was left after compilation.
Got it. Okay. Another thing that you had mentioned that you were comfortable talking about and that you've done presentations on are some of the more esoteric parts of Link. Can you tell me about that and why I would want to go beyond the basics of Link?
Well, many have a misperception about what Link is. And to be honest, I had this misperception too, and I was actually corrected on an online forum somewhere after I wrote an article called Link is Better Than For Each. I made the mistake of saying that it's necessary to have innumerable T to use Link. Well, it turns out that you don't. And after someone proved it to me, they sent me to all the papers from Eric Myers and such. And after reading up on this, someone else had posted a project, say, this proves you don't need innumerable T, because I asked for proof. They posted a project up. Can't remember the name, something like Kemet. It was actually using what's known as common error monads to put together functions. And I was looking at this library, and I was like, based upon what I just learned, I don't even need these monads. Excuse me, it's called a continuation monad. I don't need this monad representation in C# to make this work. Because of the language features of C#, I can apply them directly to functions. So I started working on something I call link to functions, and I basically put link combinators, functional combinators using link, and it's pretty cool. There was one portion that was very difficult. So I had one of my test cases was building a hypotenuse function using link. That needs to work as from h n square, square being a function of x times x, from h n square, from w n square, select square root h plus w. Now, to make this work, I had to write an extension method for select many on func t comma t result. And I had it structured almost perfectly, and then it still wouldn't work. And I went through it a few times before I discovered that Link is actually built as a DSL for list comprehension. It's meant to manipulate sequences of some sort. Well, they expected you to have in your second argument to pass in the index from the first sequence. And since I was using functions, I didn't really need that. So what I ended up doing is just making that particular function have that the appropriate signature, and I passed in nothing, default int. So that turned out to be no big deal. But extending from there, besides doing link to functions, I started playing around with applying it to other data structures, such as graphs, and the specification pattern, and anything that I can think of to apply that DSL to, I try it out to see what will happen. Yeah, I find it pretty fun. And to answer your question, why should I care? I don't really know. it's an interesting exercise in the language, and you can build very interesting APIs from it that may lend itself to more readability, which is what I'm aiming for. And it can also encourage you to think about it in different ways. For example, the little graph library I've been building, and I'm using it for my esoteric link presentation, I had to think about the graphs in a different manner. For example, it's really easy to manipulate graphs if they're mutable, but because the way we use link, we expect it to be immutable, and that helps you avoid bugs, which is part of my declarative refactoring presentation. I had to think about the graphs from an immutable perspective, and it kind of lent itself to writing the code in a slot in a different manner. Took a little more to think about, but I think it ends up being a much better API in the end.
Okay, that's very cool. Before I let you go, You said earlier that you're putting together a conference. Tell me about that conference. I know I'm speaking there, but besides that, tell me about who's going to be there and what the conference is all about.
It sounds like you're like, why did I agree to this? Or what did I agree to?
Oh, Chris, anything you ask, I agree, and then I find out what it is.
be careful. I might find something funny for you to go to. Okay, so we haven't had a code camp in Colombia for the past couple of years, and I was involved with organizing one of them. But the facilities that we chose, because they're willing to give it to us free, I mean, it's a community event. We don't really have money except for what we can ask sponsors for. And so we want to try to save as much money as possible to provide food and make sure everyone's comfortable. The facilities that we're able to obtain, and thanks to ECPI for offering those to us, it lends itself better to a different format. Code camps are one-day multi-track conferences, and you expect to have the speakers expect to have rooms large enough to accommodate the crowds. And this place has rooms that could probably accommodate smaller crowds, but really there's one large conference room, and there's several rooms that are really great for labs. So I decided that it would probably be, or actually I discussed it with some of our other community leaders, and we decided that it would be best if we changed the focus from a code camp to a day of Windows 8. We were going to do a day of something. We chose Windows 8 because it's the new exciting thing that's here. So we're putting that together now. We're going to have one main conference room for presentations. So if you want to sit back and learn about Windows 8, that's great. Go attend that. And we're also going to run workshops. So if you want to get your hands dirty, put together some code and make some Windows Store apps, then that's going to be available too. And I really hope by the end of the day that we do a competition between the Windows Store apps that our attendees write.
Great. We will put up your blog on the show page so that people can find your blog. And from there, I assume once things are settled, they'll be able to find a link to information about that presentation as well.
Which presentation?
To the conference, the Day of Windows. Or do you already have a link for that?
The conference, Day of Windows 8, is actually, we haven't settled upon a date yet. It's either going to be on January 19th or January 26th. I am waiting until Monday, because it turns out that this particular week, most people are on vacation. I need to hear back from some of my Microsoft contacts to see when they can actually come out and support us.
Got it. Okay, we'll look forward to that. And I assume you'll be putting up a notice on your blog about where and when.
Yes, once I actually have the dates finalized and I have the speakers selected, I will definitely put up an agenda on my blog. And in fact, I think we're going to put up on ColumbiaCodeCamp.org as well.